Hi, this is the Moving Toward Inclusive Practice podcast, a production of the Military Families Learning Network's Family Transitions Concentration Area. I'm Bob Birch, and we're continuing our conversation about cultural competence and inclusive practice with Dr. Ann Phibbs. Ann is the founder and president of Strategic Diversity Initiatives and brings over 25 years' experience helping organizations advance their equity, diversity, and inclusion goals. Our conversations with Dr. Phibbs are focusing on five spheres of cultural competence: seeking out stories, practicing humility, listening, asking questions, and engaging with others. In this episode, we're going to be talking about practicing humility. So let's get started. Welcome. It's great to have you here at the podcast, and it's great as well to welcome Dr. Phibbs again. Welcome, Ann.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So practicing humility, I think, is kind of a complex idea. So what do you think humility looks like in this context of cultural competence and inclusion?
Yeah. One of the first ideas that comes to mind around humility is a sense of self-awareness, of recognizing what space you take up. And there's a lot of different ways to take up space. I mean, we obviously can physically take up space. We can kind of psychically take up space, you know, in terms of how central we put our own needs first. We certainly can take up space in terms of talking. That's something that I struggle with. I mean, here on the podcast, I think you want me to talk, so that's okay. But I like to talk. I have a lot of ideas. And if I'm not careful, and sometimes I'm not careful enough, I take up more space linguistically, in terms of ideas, in terms of what I'm thinking and feeling and wanting to express, because there's a limited amount of space. So if everyone takes up the maximum amount, there's not enough space. And connected to the notion of cultural competence, connected to the notion of oppression, marginalized identities, what we know is that we are trained, you know, socialized, acculturated to expect certain people to take up more space than others. An example of this would be gender, where lots of studies show that men are more inclined to take up space. Interesting thing happened, you may know what happened when Uber had as a company had a lot of challenges with, almost positive it was Uber, had a lot of challenges with perceived sexism. And so they invited, what's the woman who started the Huffington Post? Ariana Huffington. There we go. Yeah. That helped to think of. So Ariana Huffington, they called an all-team meeting, everyone in the company, right? And so up on the stage is Ariana Huffington, who had been just, my understanding was, appointed to the board of Uber, and there were other board members. And so she makes this statement. She says, one thing we know is that if you, as you get more women on your boards, you know, you'll get more women on your boards, right? So women will want to join a board when there are already women on the board. Mm-hmm. And a male board member said, what you'll get if you have more women is a lot more talking. Just completely buying into this stereotype, which is interesting for two reasons. One, he ended up stepping down from the Uber board after that, because talk about a missed opportunity for cultural competence and reading the room. But also, the studies show exactly the opposite. And this is often what happens, is we have a notion that women never shut up, right? That women are catty, that women gossip, that women are constantly talking. The studies show men are much more likely to talk in public and in private. And I will share my lived experience as a trainer, is that I find that it's very common that I will have a room overwhelmingly filled with women. We know that generally women tend to be more open to being trained than men and more likely to voluntarily select to go to a training. So I'll have a room with maybe 75% women, 25% men or less. And overwhelmingly, the men will find their voice. Mm-hmm. Not just because they push through other women, but women hold back. So I have a table with one man and six women, and I ask the table to share, and would someone please volunteer? And overwhelmingly, not only does the man is likely to volunteer, but the women are actually just as likely to volunteer him. So these are stereotypes. We're perpetuating stereotypes, which means it won't work to just kind of trust that if we just, that kind of what happens naturally is equitable. And often it's the opposite. So much of this work is about intentionality and saying, I have to pay attention to how much I talk. I have to pay attention to how much space I take up. I have to pay attention to who I listen to, who I believe. Because another piece of that notion of kind of humility is even taking credit for other people's work. So another story, I was working with a young CEO, I mean relatively young, I think he's in his 30s, maybe early 40s, he's male. And he told me that he had gone to a meeting of other CEOs, and he started to notice how often the men talked over the women. And then even when the women made a comment, men would pick up on it and credit, you know, the credit would be given to the man. And when he went to a woman and said, wow, I noticed these gender dynamics, she looked at him and said, yeah, you know, like, but that's a huge shift to start to notice something you never had to notice before. You never had to notice. I don't have to notice race as a white person. Mm-hmm. I have to train myself to notice it. And in that respect, be humble about my own ability, right? Have some humility that I'm going to make mistakes, that I shouldn't trust my instinct or my natural thought because it's likely connected to bias. So those are some of my initial thoughts about that.
Yeah, it's interesting, the story that you told about the CEO. I kind of think about also, not to purposely take us away from the gender or cultural conversation, but just how this works into existing hierarchies. So in our audience of helping professionals, there's a natural, I shouldn't say natural, but there's a structural power dynamic. And so I wonder if for helping professionals to be aware of that as well, not just in terms of cultural and gender dynamics, but in terms of just the power dynamics of someone being a helping professional, dealing with a client, how you do that in a humble way.
Exactly, right. Have some humility. How tempting it is when you've seen maybe the same kind of behavior over and over to just feel like, I'm going to go into this situation because I know what the right answer is. Mm-hmm. And even if you do ultimately get to that answer, how you interact with that client about getting to that answer will make a huge difference on whether they feel listened to. So you can come in and go, oh, I've seen this 20 times. I mean, we all have an experience of not knowing something, of needing help, right? And when we need help, we're vulnerable. And how different it is when someone comes in, especially if they know a lot, and say, oh, hey, I'm glad I can help. Let me teach this to you, or let me share with you what I'm doing, but I'm glad you asked, and I'm really glad I could help. And, you know, that kind of openness, that kind of being humble. We know how different that feels than the person who comes in. I always think of IT people, a little bit stereotypical, but kind of like the people who really know stuff and I don't. And it's kind of like, did you try this? And it's like, no, of course, that's why I called you, because I've tried things and it's not working. But I know they know more, and they know they know more. But is there a way that they can, I still don't have to feel bad.
Right.
Right? So how can we be in it with someone, even if we have a lot more knowledge, and even if we have a lot more power over them? Because you're right. In work situations, there are hierarchies, there are structures. You can pretend they're not there, but actually a supervisor who pretends there's no hierarchy is boundaryless. That's not a good thing. You need to know your boundaries when you're supervising. And you need your boundaries when you're working with clients. So that keeps safety for them, for both of you really, but especially for them, right, as the most vulnerable. The clients are the most vulnerable. They're the ones who need something, right? So how do you approach them, even when you have the answer, even when you have something they need, in a way that keeps as much power as possible with them, mm-hmm. which is and that can be challenging when you're busy, when you're stressed, makes it complicated when this is a client that's hard for you, that's been pushing on you, that isn't the nicest client, because that happens, right? I always, as a teacher, used to talk about, you can't just teach the ones you like. You right. have to teach to those students who are like, oh my gosh, one more time from you, right? Mm-hmm. But how do you hold them in relationship and make them feel every bit as respected? Or the students you really completely disagree with, right? You're like, the way they see the world is not the way you see the world. Mm-hmm. But how can you feel, be as committed to their education as to the person who loves everything you say?
Right.
And that's tempting not to do that.
Yeah.
It's challenging.
I love that you brought up vulnerability. I kind of think of this myself. When we were doing our pre-production meetings and stuff for the podcast, I sort of framed it as I'll be the dumb white guy, because I am the dumb white guy. And so I come with all the privilege, and I come with maybe all, you know, more of the biases potentially than some others. And so I've had to sort of practice that vulnerability and that humility. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough thing to do when you're used to having the power to make yourself vulnerable and say, like, I don't understand yep. this cultural competency stuff. I need help. I need, you know, I right. need to have people who'll be willing to help me. And so, yeah, telling that story to myself, of like reminding myself of how does it feel to be the vulnerable person, or when I asked for help, I needed help. I really needed somebody. I wonder if that kind of storytelling to yourself could help us when we do have the power in a structure or hierarchy, to kind of remind ourselves how it feels to be on the other side of the desk.
Could not agree with you more, absolutely. I was doing a training, and I had a particular person in this training who kind of pushed back, and I won't go into why it was complicated, but it was complicated. And they kind of derailed the training a little bit, and I ended up getting kind of red in the face, and because I'm aware that I'm losing time, and I'm, you know, and it all turned out fine, talking to a person who works with me, wonderful person, Hannah, and I said, oh, that was really challenging, that was, you know, I don't know if I did it right, I feel vulnerable, and Hannah looks at me and goes, yeah, you're always telling people, you know, this work is about being vulnerable, and I looked right at her, and I said, yeah, but not me.
Yeah, no, that's like, not for me.
Right, not me, I'm the trainer, right, and I thought, oh, that was the dumbest thing I've ever said, you know, of course, yes, no one escapes it, right. No one escapes being human, and so when we can remember, when I say to people, oh, you know, I need us to shift the vulnerability, so men are feeling vulnerable talking about gender, so white people are feeling vulnerable talking about race, and I say it as if it's like, yes, go buy a lollipop. It's not like, I have to remember, this is not easy. There are very strong reasons why we avoid being vulnerable, and we may have grown up in a family where to show vulnerability caused abuse, right? You know, so to recognize that people come to it from very different places, and yet, to say that white people are going to be able to engage in a conversation around race and cultural competence, around understanding racism, understanding their white privilege, without being vulnerable, I don't think it's going to happen. Right. I don't think they're going to do that work, because it's deeply emotional work. It brings up shame, it brings up guilt, it brings up bad feelings that we have to make peace with so that we can continue to move forward, because nobody does anything good when they feel bad, so you have to figure out what to do with that. Mm-hmm. And then the situations change. You and I were talking earlier about this notion of if you know that you're someone who takes up space, should you always purposely not take up space? And the tricky part about that is, I think the real leader on diversity and inclusion, the real leader, person who can really understand cultural competence, is someone who can move back and forth, but knowing how to manage humility and power in ways that move an agenda forward. So what do I mean by that? I mean the white man who knows that if he goes into a particular meeting and talks about diversity and inclusion, he'll be listened to differently than his colleague of color, who will be assumed to have an agenda. Realizing he can, that when he speaks up at this meeting, actually he's advancing a diversity and an equity agenda. Mm-hmm. That if he says, no, in every space I need to be quiet, that's actually not forward thinking. That's not leadership. Leadership is, where do I need to listen? Where do I need to be quiet? Where do I need to have voices that have always been marginalized held up? And how do I model that for other white people, men, cisgender folks, people without disabilities? How do I model that? But then realizing that every person has to be a change maker at some point, which does mean speaking up. But, and then, you know, it's tempting. Oh, I'll talk about race with my friends of color because I assume they want to talk about it. That's a big assumption. But anyway, but then when I'm with my white friends, I never talk about it. Right. Or, you know, I have people who are like, they'll talk all about LGBT stuff with me, but then I'm like, okay, well, when you're at, you know, family barbecue, are you talking about it as much or no? And that's because that's that kind of like, yeah, I'm fine doing it when it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
But am I pushing myself to have the conversations that are challenging and find a way to be modeling how to be someone with privilege who talks about things?
Right.
And again, goes back to that notion of how do I use what I have? So I do have, how do I use my privilege?
Right.
Instead of, because it doesn't work to deny it. And no one buys it when you deny it anyway. Like,
right.
Oh, I'm like everyone else. No, you're not. You can actually, there's a study, I think it was the London School of Economics, and they had a white man talking about diversity, a white woman, man of color, woman of color. The only person of those four that was rated positively for talking about diversity was the white man. So every other person, it was perceived that it was they had an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So first off, be annoyed because that shouldn't happen, but it does. But then after that, say, okay, I have some power. I can bring things forward. And how do I do it in a way that doesn't elevate me personally as aren't I the coolest?
Right.
So, for example, as a white person, can I say, look, I'm going to share some things about race, and I want to be clear, every single thing I learned around how racism works in this country was learned from Native people and people of color.
Right.
But, yes, I will talk about it to advance, to end racism, to move toward ending racism and creating racial equity.
Yeah.
Because some people might hear it from me in a different way. So this is the complexity, to be able to hold those things.
Yeah. At the risk of elevating a white voice on this, but Tim Mary talks about this. So Tim Mary and Tuesday Ryan Hart, who do some work together and have a great podcast, by the way, if you're looking for another podcast besides ours to listen to. And, you know, Tim is from the UK. He grew up in a very privileged background, of course, and he's a white man. And so he gets to stand up in front of people and talk about, you know, how we... You know, about equity and diversity and inclusion in ways that I'm sure makes him feel weird. And I've felt that, too. And we've been talking, you brought up vulnerability, and we've been talking about humility, too. And I think there's some threads to be pulled there in terms of when you're talking about where do we have these conversations, do we just have them in safe spaces, or do we have them, you know, that takes vulnerability. It takes, like, risk of, like, being called out. And it's like, you know, why are you talking about this? Either by, you know, minority communities or by other people who are like you, other white men.
Because if we're really if we're really risking taking risks, which is what we need to do, then we'll start to see the ways that people with privileged identities who bring these things up get marginalized. So, for example, I'll never forget I once... had someone from the GLBT community, another white person, and we were talking about a white colleague, but this colleague who's also in the community is very committed to anti-racism. And this person I was having lunch with said, oh yeah, she's politically correct around race. And it was one of the first times I'd noticed this kind of pushback toward a white person of she talks too much about racism in the LGBT community. And the same thing, you know, again, you're going to talk about gender with your women friends, but when you're on the hockey team with your guy buddies and somebody says a homophobic joke or makes a comment about a woman's body, are you going to be the one who says, hey, I don't want to be part of that? And then what does that look like,
mm-hmm.
right? Do you become the, oh, come on, man, you know it's not a big deal. knock it off. We're just having fun. What all the ways that you get start to get pushback, because it impacts our identities. It impacts, you know, the idea that, I'll be this advocate, this champion, this really leader, but it won't impact my personal relationships. I don't think that's true. I think it does. Mm-hmm. And might make things challenging if you're really doing it well.
Yeah.
And then to realize a whole nother piece of the humility is, am I willing to keep going with it even when I don't get acknowledgement from marginalized communities? So one of my sheroes is Audre Lorde. I've been reading her for a long time. She's, you know, amazing Black woman, lesbian, poet, warrior. I think that's how she described herself. She was both a poet and a theorist. She passed away far too young in the mid-90s. I was talking with some colleagues about kind of race dynamics and wanting to getting kind of excited as a white person on your journey and wanting to engage with people. And this woman told me this wonderful story. She's a white woman, and she's lesbian like me, this woman. And this was many years ago in the 90s when there was a big women's studies conference at the U of M, and Audre Lorde was one of the keynotes. So this white lesbian who's also about my same age, you know, she said, oh, I was the same thing. Like, I love Audre Lorde. So I walked up to her, and I was like, you know, oh, my gosh, I think you're amazing, and just wanting to engage with her. And she just shut me down, not in a rude way. She wasn't rude or mean, but she just made it really clear that at that moment, she didn't have the energy. Like, she was just like, I can't do this with you, right? And I said, oh, man, that would be so hard. But what we talked about is, yeah, you know, like, if you're doing it to get the kudos from, you know, to look cool, to get the kudos, then you're doing it for, you know, well, that's not going to sustain you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to keep staying in this work when it gets hard. Not if. It's not an if, it's a when. When it gets hard, when it gets messy, when it gets challenging, when it gets hurtful. Because people with marginalized identities never walk away. That's
right.
How you know you have privilege. So holding ourselves accountable is saying, oh, you know, I came to this Black Lives Matter meeting and I didn't take over and I tried, you know, but I still, like, it felt like maybe they didn't want me there as a white person. Oh, I'm done with this race stuff. Well, you know, the humility is, okay, I showed up. What's my next step? Maybe I should talk to some other white folks. Maybe I should do some reading. Maybe I should ask some people if they'd have a conversation with me. And if they don't, be totally respectful if they say no.
Mm-hmm.
And start to realize that I'm responsible for myself on this journey. And there's a lot I have access to online, and I don't have to learn it at the expense of my colleagues or friends of color, but I better stay in it. And if I think I'm going to take a lifetime of bias and shed it like a coat, I'm fooling myself.
Right.
And so the humility is like, yeah, I'm in it like everyone else. That's the other piece.
Yeah.
Because the one other thing I want to add that I think can be a real challenge to this work, there can be a lack of humility on the part of some social justice activists. And it's not always about a particular social identity. There was a great article, and I don't know the name of it or anything, but it was a queer activist in Seattle. And this activist said, oh, my gosh, we live in this call-out culture. You know, part of it's fueled by social media, right? So I can just immediately tell you exactly what you did wrong. But it's also personal. And this person was writing saying, I now go to, like, these organizing meetings where everyone is freaked out about saying anything because I'm going to get nailed on it, called on it immediately. And that is a very damaging kind of hyper-political culture. I mean, and we need a strong analysis. We need to call each other out and call each other in. But when we do it with just that slightest bit of arrogance, because we're all like dogs. Like, you know how, like, dogs can smell other dogs. You can smell disrespect. You can smell arrogance. I do. I can tell pretty quickly when someone feels they're a little bit special compared
right.
to me. And if I ever do it, and I'm human, I probably do it. I hope someone calls me out on it, right? Because it doesn't build relationship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is it when we've been in it a long time, when we're really woke, when we're really in it, and we meet someone who's really new? Goes back to that early thing about do you want to be the person who like says, oh, I can't believe you just, are you kidding me? You don't understand, because I was you don't understand pronouns. I was just in a training where someone looked at me and I was talking about how we don't want to say preferred pronouns anymore. This is something I'm learning. We say just what pronouns, pronouns do you use? And this person looked at me and said, what, pronouns? I don't even, didn't even know what that was. Well, if I looked at her like, are you kidding me? She's not going to learn anything. And who am I to think, that's not going to be me tomorrow.
Right.
That's the humility that no one comes out of preschool or high school knowing every word to say, knowing every frame, knowing all the history. Every single one of us is on this journey. Mm-hmm. And when I'm on a journey and can say, I don't know where you're at, but, you know, oh, you're farther behind. Well, come on, I'll wait up. I'll take my hand. I'll tell you what I learned, and we'll find someone farther ahead who can help keeping us on this journey. Like, you want that image. Mm-hmm. That's what I think of when I think about the humility, because nothing kills connection like arrogance, and it often hides insecurity. We all know.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the irony, right?
Yeah.
Is that I come across as the person who's got the answer, and what I'm really scared to death is you're going to see I'm like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can push past that and say, yeah, of course there are people who, you know, I had this young woman come up to me and she was in tears and she said, I just got hired at this job. I'm working with students. And she said it was really a hard moment because they told me, we hired you not because, but in spite of the fact that you referred to people as homosexuals. And what they said to her, this search committee, was, we know that if you really had experience with people in the LGBT community, you wouldn't use that word.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of saying, that's why we didn't hire you, they educated her. And she said it was so helpful. I didn't know, right? We so often don't know what we don't know.
Right.
And so judge me on what I do with what you tell me, not whether I need to be told. Because no one doesn't, you know, everyone's on a learning curve.
Yeah. I love how you just described that, and I love the idea of a journey. And I think, you know, what I'm hearing is that part of humility is seeing ourselves on a journey alongside, right? Or, well, no, with.
Yeah.
Not alongside,
but,
right? Not
right.
In front of or behind.
Right.
But with,
yep,
other people.
Yep.
And maybe that helps with the, you know, the conflict and those things.
And that everyone gets to be on that journey if they choose to be on it.
Right.
So the person who comes up and says, no, you don't belong on the journey, that's not helpful. Now, that doesn't mean you get to lead the journey. That doesn't get to mean, I've got the bullhorn, right? Mm-hmm. This is all the self-awareness.
Right.
But nobody gets to say, oh, you're too male, you're too rich, you're too cisgender, you're too this, you're too that, you're hopeless, right? No one is, right? Or to say, you're so many things that you don't need to do the work.
Right.
Because every single one of us has to do the work. Yeah. It's just going to look different for different people.
Well, I'm glad you're a part of my journey.
Yeah.
Definitely a great conversation today. And for those of you listening, we're glad to have you along on this journey as well. Thank you for listening. The links to the other podcasts in this series, all of the resources that Ann talked about, as well as more information from Anne and others about cultural competence, they're all going to be on our podcast page. You can find it at militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/family-transitions. You can find out more about Anne's work at strategicdi.com. Thank you so much for listening. This material is based on work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense Award Number 2015-48770-24368.